Okay. Ready we are. Right. Okay. Good. I the written exercises from last Wednesday are down here for you to pick up. They were 3 points. What should you have written? This was the prompt. So what should you have written? Why is moving into a new apartment in a cohabiting relationship an ecological transition? An ecological transition is a change in a role or setting, a person's position in the ecosystem. So it is an ecological transition if and because it includes a change in setting and a change in role. Okay? Either one or both of those, whenever you see ecological transition, think position in the ecosystem, role, setting. Okay. And how does it change one's ecosystem? When you see ecosystem, what should you be thinking about? Relations? The ecosystem that they're in, which means thinking about the microsystem and the mesosystem and the exosystem. You don't have to think about the macrosystem or the chronosystem, but you probably do want to think about the macrosystem. Yeah. And if you're going to talk about relations and the microsystem, then you probably also want to think about pattern of relations, activities, and
both.
Thank you. Okay. Right? You got it. I mean, if you did that, then you've got it. Let me repeat the advice in the syllabus and that I've given before. On anything that you write for here, think Bronfenbrenner and use the concepts in everything that you write. A few of you gave interesting descriptions of how life would be different and what kinds of problems you could run into, but those are not the concepts from Develop Ecology. Okay? So these are opportunities for you to practice interpreting things using Bronfenbrenner. Okay? So in the points that I assigned, I was looking for ecological transition and aspects of the ecosystem. You didn't have to give me all of them, but something that specifically connected to those concepts. Okay? And I didn't take off for grammar, spelling. They were all legible. Okay. Questions about the writing exercise? Okay. Questions about assignment 5? Coming up, we've been over this, and just want to remind you that you should be drafting it and thinking about it. Again, thinking about the Develop Ecology, if you really looked at Bronfenbrenner's concepts and hypotheses, all of that stuff about facilitating development if you were in charge of somebody's development, particularly a child or children, you're in charge, what would you do if you believed and applied those hypotheses? So think about the activities, think about the roles, think about the microsystem, think about the mesosystem. What are you going to do? And then you have to think about how you would operationalize, is the scientific term for that. Take steps to make it real. You have the hypothesis, the set of hypotheses. What would you actually do to make that happen? Then you get to boil that down to six rules or guidelines for your refrigerator door. And if you want, if you give me the instruction, we will hold on to those somewhere in my archive with the instruction to send them to you when you have the suspicion that you might be pregnant. Question.
Do you have any expertise for like age range that we should apply? Some rules that apply for like babies or parenting, do you have any expectations for that?
Right, good question. The question is, do I have any expectation that you will cover the whole age range, 0 to 18, or 25 or 35? No. No, I don't have a specific expectation that you cover the whole range, particularly in your examples. The follow-up question is likely to be, is it okay if, since I'm an early childhood major, may I focus on the first 5 or 6 years? Or since I'm an L.Ed. major, may I focus on the elementary school years? The answer to that is yes. I had to consult my guides about that. Yes, and you heard that here. Okay, so you may focus on a particular age range if you choose. You may focus on adolescence, you may focus on elementary school, you may focus on early childhood. Do not focus just on infancy, that's too small. Okay. That should make reading more interesting. Okay. Emily. It's an intriguing idea. The observation is that some families have household rules that everyone has to follow.
Like I've seen a list, like they have
yeah.
A
what I'm concerned about in that is that you are in the business of making sure that, as the responsible person, you are facilitating the development of the children. There's another exercise which Talia is now writing down, which would be lots of fun to do, which is if you wanted to facilitate your own development using the... Ooh, I smell a final exam question. Write that down. You applying Bronfenbrenner to facilitate your own development. Thank you. And we'll blame Emily if that shows up on the... I like that. I actually do have a couple of final exam questions that I've used in the past, such as, if you're going to be a good developologist, how would you arrange the transition from college into whatever comes next? How would you arrange that so that it facilitates your development as well as possible. That's a question I've used several times in the past. Not in this course, but in another course, in 161. But it would be fun in this course, too. I'm thinking about whether or not I need to add anything to your original question, Emily. I think my concern with looking at household rules for everybody is that parents have a responsibility to arrange the ecosystem for children in a way that is facilitating. And I'm not sure that you wouldn't get off track focusing on rules for everybody. Only because I haven't written it yet, so I don't know. But I would be wary of that. Tiffany. The question is, would it be okay to focus some of the rules on young children and some of them on the teenage years? Probably. Thinking about hypothetical essays, I'm trying to think about where one might end up in a cul-de-sac. Talking about the wrong things in doing that, but I'm hung up on the first one of letting children do whatever they want. I understand that's not what you would do, but so that they can develop motor activities that they are particularly interested in and motivated for, but I'm not sure how that doesn't apply to adolescents. Okay, so we need to think about that one a little bit more. Let me go to the assumption under the question, which would be that you do not have to focus on any particular age group. And it would be and is and will be an interesting and important exercise in testing what you want to write as rules, whether they might apply to any age or whether they are so specific that they apply only to a particular age, but you would not have to do all of your rules or your examples, illustrations of them, for a particular age group. So you can mix and match in how you describe and explain them. Does that help? I'm sorry, pertains to the child's? Yes, you can. Yes, you may write rules that are general enough to apply to the whole age span of childhood and adolescence. Yeah. Emily?
Required to follow in compliance with the parents.
underlined and in bold. Raising children. Right. So these are rules for parents. Not what kids have to do. But they're obviously related. But focus on the parenting end, because that's where you will be. It's too late for you. You have all been raised, you have gotten through childhood, and the rest of life is just overcoming the happy childhood that you have. Any other questions about the exercise? And I believe Talia offered to read drafts if they arrive before the 14th. Just going to ruin the weekend, right? Well, you took the last two or three off, didn't you? Okay, and then as soon as she... Actually, between now and the time you get these, you could work on the final exam. In case you had any spare time. Okay, happy Passover. All right. Any other questions or... housekeeping details? Questions about anything I said on Wednesday? No problem getting the readings? Okay. All right. There's about where we were. We were starting to talk about marriage. And I made some more or less random comments about why you would, well, you made some comments that weren't random, they were focused on why you might choose to marry, and I was talking about some of the changes that take place when couples get married, including suggesting that it would be nice if you had a list handed to you when you took out a marriage license that explained all of these changes in your legal status, both as an individual and as a couple, because there are whole bunches of things that change when you sign that marriage certificate. I was startled when I got married a while back to discover that there didn't have to be any ceremony at all in Vermont. We met for cappuccino at Klinger's, and friend of mine's a justice of the peace, so we had the marriage certificate-y thing, and we had a cappuccino, and she let me pay for that, but not for her services. And the question that you have to answer is, are you entering this of your own free will? And are you of sound or reasonably sound, or are you sane enough to order a cappuccino? That's about it. And then you sign. Each of you signs. You put your name on this piece of paper and you sign it. And then when she signs it, that's it. That's all there is to it. You don't have to promise anything or do anything. And you have changed your legal status forever by doing that. It's really quite an awesome and very deceptive and misleading process. Because it seems to be so simple. It's actually not legal until she goes to the, or the, whoever has the certificate, takes it to the town clerk and it gets stamped, then it's legal and then it's done. But it has to be registered with the town clerk before you're actually married. So you can't just jump into bed right away, legally, as man and wife. But it is incredibly deceptive because it does change your relationship in many, many ways. You're changing the roles from cohabiting to married partners. You are telling the community that you are husband and wife and you are committed to each other and that you have all these financial obligations. It's important to remember that when you start dating somebody who is getting divorced, that infamous phrase, getting divorced, until a person is divorced, the person still has all of those obligations. And it's important to remember that, especially since some people seem to get in the habit of being in the process of getting a divorce for 7 or 8 years, 10 years, while they string you along as the other person, and then they never get divorced. And you may be living with them, but if they're not divorced, you don't have any rights. You're telling the community, you're making a public commitment, and asking for many of us, asking for their support for this union that has been created. The legal marriage, as we were describing it, includes privileges and obligations. The obligation to pay the partner's debts, obligation to support, obligation to be the provider of first resort if in case something happens. It changes your ability to sign contracts, take out a loan, buy a car, anything else that involves debt, requires the other person to know about that. When you get older, or some of you have parents who may be facing it, if you have a pension and die, the spouse has to receive at least 50% of that pension. You can give the rest of it to anybody you want, but the spouse has to receive at least 50% of it. And if you don't want to give the spouse 50% of it, that's okay too, but the spouse has to agree and sign a form that says, I understand I'm not getting half. I understand that, and it's okay. I approve. Which was an interesting law when it got passed a few years ago, because it caught out a whole bunch of spouses who were being deceptive about pensions, telling their spouses, well, of course you get it, but you can, in fact, when you have a pension, you have to, as an individual, declare your beneficiaries. And it's possible to hide that from a spouse. But now the law is that you can't hide it from a spouse if you're giving the spouse or assigning the spouse less than half of that pension if you die. So people suddenly discovered that they needed to change their beneficiaries and give more money to their spouses. The spouses have a right. Because they're spouses, not because they're nice people or because they need the money, just because they're spouses. Inheritance is automatic for spouses. You get a tax break, or depending on who's in Congress, you get a tax break or a tax penalty for being married. It complicates things. I spent part of the weekend preparing our tax returns, and mine is simple, but not everybody's is. Parentage. If you get pregnant while you are married, or if you have a child while you are married, the child is the legal offspring of your spouse, regardless of who the biological father is. And that's all there is to it. Because the assumption is, if you're married at the time the child is born, that the person you're married to is the spouse, is the father. Right. The person you're married to usually is the spouse and is the father if you have a child while you're married.
I was reading my father's best help.
You were what?
Reading my dad's best help, like another game.
You're reading your dad's men's help. Got it, okay.
But there's an article about how just like a wide number of fathers in this country that are raising children that are not their own.
That's true. Well, some of them do, but many of them don't. The observation is, according to Men's Health, many, it's a good magazine, many men are raising and supporting children who are not their own biologically, and they don't know that. And that is true. There are many men who are raising their own non-biological children and do know it and choose not to contest that. And it doesn't matter legally. It does not matter. As I understand the law, and don't quote me, therefore I probably shouldn't say anything. I'll say it anyway. But I could be wrong, but as I understand it, even if the child is not yours biologically, it is yours legally. If you are married to the mother at the time of the birth. The observation is that if you get divorced and you know that one of the children is not biologically yours and you have DNA evidence to support that, you are still going to pay child support. Because the law says the child is born to your spouse while you are married, it is yours. Child support will be reduced if you have no income, except for the 10 cents an hour that you earn in prison because you went out and shot the biological father. But, or the mother, or both of them. But anyway. So, marriage changes parentage laws and how they apply to you, and it's very important to be aware of that. In the case of a divorce, sometimes biological fathers do petition to have visitation rights and parental rights. And in those cases, that can only be done if the non-biological but legal father relinquishes his parental rights, which in those cases some people are quite happy to do. But you don't have any legal right to your biological child if it is born while the mother is married to somebody else. Yeah. That was your question, right? No. You have no legal right or obligation. But in a divorce situation, if you want to assert paternity, then that might happen. We see that, for example, in the out-of-wedlock recent child born to Anna Nicole Smith. I never thought I would mention her in a lecture, but I just did. All right. I do not understand our fascination, but anyway, a couple of people are claiming paternity and requesting DNA tests because they want her surviving child. That will be fairly simple. But wait till the tabloids find out what I really secretly know, which is that neither of them is the father. DNA tests will demonstrate that, and then they have to figure out who is really. I just made that up. Okay. I'm not going there. Okay, medical decisions. You get to pull the plug on each other if you're married. When you marry, you become next of kin. And that is an important change. When you are cohabiting, you are not next of kin. So in that situation, if you are not married, then one of the unpleasant realities is that it's your parents who get to pull the plug if something happens to you and you're in a coma. They get to make the medical decisions if you are not capable of it. they have no legal requirement to consult the person you have lived with for the last 25 years, if you're not married. They may make those decisions without consulting you if the hospital or physician recognizes them as next of kin. And if you are not married, you cannot be recognized as next of kin because you are an unrelated person. And then the parents can be nice and say, that's okay, you know, we want to share that. I'm sorry? That is, yes, the question is whether that's what is problematic about the 48 states who have, or is it 47? What happened last week? Anyway, one of the purposes of allowing civil unions or marriage in the case of same-sex couples is that it permits you to be next of kin. Both civil union and marriage allow you to do that. In Vermont, for example, the civil union law essentially says you get anything that a married couple gets, you get legally, except that nobody else recognizes it, so you need to be in the hospital in Vermont. This is important. You can, and this is the other piece of that, you can create all of those obligations that I took off the overhead, you can create all of those by contract. So you can and should, if you are in a cohabiting or a non-legally recognized relationship, you can create the legal obligation, you can designate a person to make the decisions for you. Medical power of attorney, durable power of attorney for medical, for health care. You can assign that to anyone. You can give it to anybody. But you have to do it legally, and you have to have the document with you, and you have to file it. Most of us don't carry ours around with us, but the hospital and our primary care physicians and the person who is going to have that responsibility typically have copies that they can pull out if necessary. You can create the right to inherit property contractually. You can specify guardianship for children contractually, as long as you are not interfering with the legal rights of another person who would have parentage rights. Okay. So you can go through it all and do it on your own, even though you're cohabiting. You can create most of the rights and responsibilities by contract, but you have to go through that process. It's much more complicated than going to Klinger's and having a cappuccino and saying, yeah, I'm doing this voluntarily and signing your name. The question is, if you have those complicated situations where you have a gay couple, female in this case, one of whom has borne a child, and you have a biological father out there someplace, maybe, and the biological mother dies, would the biological father have rights? Probably not, because most same-sex couples who want to have a child will have the sperm donor if it's not an anonymous donation, if it's somebody that they know and have chosen. That person will typically sign a form legally saying, I have no parental rights and cannot now or ever assert them. Okay. If you're smart, that's what you'll do. One of the situations here that led to some of the changes in the law and eventually towards civil unions in Vermont was a situation like that, except the biological father didn't come forward. But the biological mother's parents did. And they petitioned the court to be named guardians for the child. And they had the child. They had the child physically because the mother's partner was injured in the same car accident. And she was unable to take care of the child. So they had taken the child and they petitioned to keep the child. And in that particular case, their petition was denied because the parents had an agreement. The biological mother had legally designated her partner as the child's guardian. And because they had done that legally, there was no legal question. So people need to do that. Civil unions make that automatic. And in part, one of the things that happened as a result of that and a couple of other cases was that Vermont was the first state to permit gay couples to adopt. And both, this was before civil unions, so couples did not have a legal connection to each other, but they were permitted to adopt and both of them be named adoptive parents. So in Vermont, actually before civil unions, you could be connected by parenting the same child and adopt the child. You could also adopt each other's biological children. And that was a big step forward. But the fact that Vermont had been so reasonable about so many other things made it an easy step towards civil unions. And it's children that bring us to our senses occasionally. Occasionally, not always, just occasionally. Okay. Are there questions about any of those rights and responsibilities? So then you get married. Keep it simple. Keep it simple. Unless you're trying to drive the partner away, then have a very complicated wedding. Spend a year of your life doing it as a molar activity, a joint molar activity. It'll actually be a group molar activity, the parents, the couple, all their friends. The wedding industry loves you. The average wedding now costs something in excess of $20,000, which is just blows my mind. But do it if you wish. I will not pass judgment on that. I will pass along a little Uncle Larry advice, which is don't go into debt to get married. It's not really a good way to start your marriage. You're probably already in debt. Don't add to it. There is no necessity to impress everybody with how big your wedding is and... Okay. You're not my kids. Do it your way. But if you invite me, I'm likely to ask. So that should kill the invitations for the next 10 years, right? So what happens when you get married? Here you are. You're a couple. You got married. Judith Wallerstein. Where'd Jackie come from? Judith Wallerstein may be familiar to you as the author of several books and a lot of articles about, and being on television a lot, about divorce and its effects on children. And generally I urge people not to read her too closely because she has a limited and very highly selected sample of misfits and unhappy people who blame their parents for their unhappiness in life because they got divorced, and in general that's pretty bogus. There are much better writers on divorce and its effect on children. One of those you have in the article by Hetherington. But After years of studying divorcing couples, Judith Wallerstein asked, "Are there any happy people who are married?" And this is the list that led to her book, The Good Marriage. And she actually wanted to find out what keeps couples together, since she had been studying the ones that were falling apart. And in her research, in which she interviewed people who had gotten married recently, she was interested in what do you have to do as you get married. Now, it's not just a piece of cake. You just go to Clingers and sign the form and there you are and everything falls into place. So she sees these as a set of initial tasks. These are the things going to occupy the first year. And couples who understand and are prepared to deal with these particular issues are likely to be happier at the end of the first year of marriage than couples who keep bumping their noses on some of the tasks that you have to do. So there are seven, and I'll just run through them. And the task here for you is to figure out what that means developmentally. What are these people doing? Consolidating separation and establishing the new connection. Even if you've been living together for a long period of time, the marital connection seems somehow to be a little different. And as you consolidate the separation, what does that mean? It means that you are separating from your families of origin, your foes, or foos, if you want. You both have a family of origin to which you are more or less connected, and some people aren't very connected and others are much more connected. And you are both separating more to create this marriage. And that's both a developmental trajectory and a mesosystem issue. From one setting to the next, and maybe there are apartments and other relationships in there as part of the developmental trajectory, and you are creating a sense that you are a married couple. That differs considerably by culture. There are cultures in which you automatically move into the husband's family. There are other cultures in which you automatically move into the wife's family and become part of them. And then there are those that are really wishy-washy like us that think people ought to live on their own and guilt trip you if you still live with your parents after you're married. And that yes, indeed. The observation is that many people discover that marriage kills their relationship. What is going on? What is going on is, in part, that people are failing these tasks. Okay. So, one of the issues is that there's a lot more to this marriage than just the wedding. So, you've got a lot of stuff to do, and this is important stuff, and it takes a lot of time and energy and negotiation skills. So marriage is actually hard work, developmentally. And people often are not prepared for that, particularly people who have not had any premarital counseling or education. And premarital counseling, premarital education often focuses on the issues that underlie these seven tasks. So they're prepared and they have support. Some of the other reasons why people fall apart when they get married is that they marry because it's the next step in the assumed developmental trajectory from cohabitation. If you've been living together all this time, then shouldn't you get married? And the answer to that often is no! You should not get married. You're poor candidates for marriage. And people often... Well, there's this little scenario that happens. None of you will have experienced this yet or will ever, I hope. But there's this little experience that happens as you're cohabiting and you're enmeshed further and further in this web of obligation to each other and this sense that you really ought to be taking the next step, but it's not happening. So one of you begins to threaten that you're out of here if the marriage isn't forthcoming, and the other one is too wimpy or too passive or too afraid of being alone to say, I am not ready to make a commitment to you. I'm sorry that we've gotten into the position where you think we need to do this. I'm perfectly happy cruising along, not learning anything, not having to go to the bars and not having to find my own company for the night. So that's just, you know, too bad. So I will live on my own for a while if you leave. But most of us are much too wimpy to do that. So we say, oh yeah, sure. Yeah, we'll get married. And then the reality of getting married kicks you in the face and hits you in the face with the reality that you are not in love with this person, you are not ready to make this commitment, and here you are, and you just did it, so you will spend the next several months undoing it in a passive, aggressive, nasty way of proving to the other person that you're not really husband or wife material. Or you just start bickering and then it all falls apart. But that's one of the scenarios. Another is that people do that and it's really a bluff. What you really want is for the other person to be active and to say, I don't think so. We need to split up. We need to go our separate ways. And the other person doesn't. The other person says, okay, we'll get married. And there you are. You've bluffed. And the other person is just going along with it. And there you are. You're married. And now you need to get out of it. No. There is no common law marriage in most states. The question was, aren't you legally sort of married if you've lived together? Some states have what is called common law marriage. Vermont does not. I think there are 17 or 18 that still do. Don't quote me again. And in those states, you are legally married after 7 or 11 years, whatever it is. But only if one person asserts that. So you don't have to get a divorce if neither of you asserts the marriage. So you can be married, I mean, you can live together forever in those states, and you only acquire the rights and responsibilities if one of you asserts that it is a common law marriage. Otherwise, it's not. But Vermont is not one of those states. Brian?
Why is it that these would all be fulfilled after marriage? Why wouldn't they be fulfilled before marriage so as to not know what you're getting yourself into, the most obvious being the first one? And the most, like, I just find number 7 almost ridiculous because in my mind it's lie to yourself while maintaining, like, the reality of the situation. Like, I don't know. Why is it that half that most of these things wouldn't just be taken care of before you get married?
Because they can't be taken. The question is, why aren't they taken care of before you get married? Because marriage changes the rules. And so even though you might have reached a resolution on each of these prior to marriage, marriage changes the depth of the commitment and the implications of it, so you have to renegotiate it. And marriage changes everybody else's view of who you are as a couple. And so they are involved. For example, in consolidating the separation, your parents may have been perfectly happy to think of you as cohabiting and ignored your partner. So you're quite happy being separate from them, but once that partner is a daughter-in-law or a son-in-law, your family has expectations because the marriage has happened. And we'll look at each of those. They are each tasks that you start when you become serious about somebody. But they change when you move in together, because that changes the ecosystem. They change again when you marry, because that changes your position in the ecosystem. It's a role change.
And just one more on what's establishing the sexual life of the couple, is that implicit of not having sexual life before marriage?
No. Number three, establishing the sexual life of the couple is something that you begin whenever you start having a sexual relationship. But it changes again when you get married.
How so?
Because your roles to each other have changed because you're now married. And I don't want to emphasize too strongly, but it's connected to Jen's question about the marriage falling apart very shortly. Marriage changes the couple relationship, and it changes it for some people in very important and deep ways that change their attitudes, the degree of reciprocity, the power in the relationship, and that often affect the affect. So for many couples, these are new tasks, or they're renewed tasks, because of the implicit changes, and sometimes explicit changes, in the reciprocity and power in the relationship, because you have a piece of paper that defines your legal responsibilities to each other.
What about when you get engaged? Because when these tasks begin, like you're engaged, is that already a person?
Engagement is another of the transition points that changes the relationship. It says, okay, we are committed to doing this. We're strengthening our commitment. It tells the whole world, I'm a fiancé. That's a verb. A fiancé means to become engaged. And when you are a fiancé, it changes your relationship in the community, changes other people's views and expectations of you. Differently than marriage, although I don't know of any research that has compared those two. They're each steps in this developmental trajectory that is leading you deeper and deeper into the relationship. Okay. There was another... Go ahead, Jen. There are other reasons, and I'll give you a couple of other possibilities, why things fall apart once you get married.
Mm-hmm.
Jen's observation is that her parents have been married over 30 years, and did it start to get rocky at about 30 years? Yeah, that's called menopause. Seriously, that's called menopause. And it affects... Number three, establishing the sexual life of the couple and reestablishing it, to take that into account. There are many reasons why marriages change over time. Let me put it reasonably simply. Any individual change that affects how you are operating in the world as a husband or as a wife affects the couple. And so most couples go through phases. I'm blocking on the name of the wonderful old woman that I usually like to criticize, but she did point out that in looking at the lifetime of a marriage, most of us go through plateaus where we're fairly happy, then we go through periods of conflict, and readjustment because we're taking into account some change that's happened. Maybe a child was born, that's a huge issue. Maybe a child leaves home, maybe a child gets sick, maybe the husband loses his job, maybe the woman goes through menopause. And then you renegotiate those and you either get divorced if you can't renegotiate them, or you continue, you reach a plateau after negotiation, and then things start to shift again because of some other change, and then you renegotiate, often with a period of conflict. You keep going through this cycle. It's not, okay, get married, get it all together, that's it forever. You thought when you got to be 21 you were going to be adults. You're still going to keep going through all of those changes, and marriages keep going through changes too. But the 30-year menopausal shift is often a very important one. And we'll talk about that a bit when we get there. Brian raised the issue of number 7, maintaining an idealized view that incorporates reality. On the next slide, I'll show you what people who have been married happily for many, many years say is the key, are the keys to the success of their marriages. And a little personal delusion about the other person and how wonderful he or she is, that other people in the family or that know you would say is a delusion, maintaining that delusion to a little bit and incorporating the reality, it goes a long way in making a marriage last. And it comes up again and again and again. Very difficult for some of us to accept that we would actually kind of ignore the reality. But as has been said, I'm sure, better by poets than by me, if we actually face the reality of any other human being without any kind of delusion, we would probably be driven to wonder why we were all human and whether or not we might become some different species, because if you actually look at us, we are a very funny kind of species. And we do really funny things, and most of us are very far from perfect. And if we don't laugh about that, we would probably cry. Yeah. So it's better to chuckle a bit and probably maintain an idealized view of the other person. Probably. A couple of the other reasons why marriages fall apart. I guess some of my favorite horror stories. Did I tell you? No, I didn't tell you. Yes, I did. I was friendly for a while with a couple who had built a house together, but it was on his land and in his name. And she had served as contractor, and she had helped design the house, and she really loved it. And they had lived together in it for a number of years. And she suspected that he wasn't really very serious about this relationship, and she knew that she had no legal rights. So he let her browbeat him into getting married. And because she just told all of his friends and his family and her family that they were eventually going to get married, and she set a date, and he was too wimpy to go along, to not go along with it. And then they got married, and then she got confirmation that he did have another woman on the side or in the middle or someplace there, and in fact had spent the morning of their wedding with the other woman. And so she filed for divorce, and the only thing she got and wanted was the house. So theirs fell apart, but theirs had fallen apart before. The marriage was just a way of making sure that she got the house that she loved. And so she kind of extorted it and blackmailed him. He was a cheater, so here we go. Other times, marriages fall apart after people have lived together for a fair amount of time because they have children. having children is a perfectly reasonable way to destroy a perfectly good relationship. It's very easy to have a great relationship if you keep the stresses to a minimum. And when we talk about what happens when you have a child, which we're going to do, we'll see that it's not all that easy to keep the relationship together when there are three of you. So having a child will destroy the marriage, and since many couples who are cohabiting get married because they are pregnant, they are then setting themselves up for the combination of changes with the marriage, but also parenting. And they're not prepared for that, and off they go. I'm going to stop with the reasons there, but there are probably more researchers and more cases that we could look at. Building the marital identity, being a couple. What happens when you go to work and you've gotten married is that you now have a spouse, not a significant other, not a life partner, not a girlfriend, boyfriend, housemate, cohabiting partner, whatever you want to, apostle Q, whatever you had. You now have a wife or a husband. You have a spouse. And that changes your identity as far as the rest of the world is concerned. And people sometimes have difficulty accepting that change for themselves, even if they have wanted to get married. There's a difference, and this is an important part of what marriage does. Wanting to be somebody's partner is different from wanting to get married. Wanting to get married is often something that people have dreamed of since they were very, very little, particularly people of the female persuasion in our culture. Let's test this. How many of you have been planning your wedding since you were 5 or 6 years old? 8, 9, 10, 11. All right, men only. How many of you have been planning your wedding since you were 15 or younger? Never. Never. In years of asking that question, I have had one man tell me that he'd been planning his wedding since he was about 8. And the saddest thing in his life was that he would never have one. I hope he lives in Massachusetts now. He was gay. He'd been planning his wedding, which isn't necessarily connected to being gay, but he'd been planning it for a long time. And many of you have been playing with your Barbies and going through the wedding thing, and far be it from us to deny you the fulfillment of your life's dream, but that is getting married. It is not being married. Being married is for the rest of your life. It is a commitment to working together. It is a commitment to being together until 30 years past menopause, when he looks like, pick your own horror story of what he's going to look like when he's 75 or 80. Yeah. Being married is very different from getting married. And taking on the identity of somebody who is married, with all of the social implications of that, you can no longer hit on anybody. We've been through that before. It changes. They can't hit on you. It makes life much less interesting. I'm not going any farther with that. Did we talk about Bowen? Did we talk about togetherness and autonomy? I know we did in 5 for some of you. Murray Bowen is one of the grand old figures of family therapy. And in looking at couples and people generally, Bowen suggests that we all have two contradictory life forces hiding within us, motivating our behavior. And one of those is the desire for autonomy. Spell it. All right. And the other is the desire for togetherness. Or separateness. And Bowen argues that we all want to be with other people, but not all the time, and we want to be autonomous and making our own decisions and able to be by ourselves for part of the time, but not all the time. He suggests that each of us has a zone. If we look across the day, the week, the month, we have some degree of togetherness and separateness in which we are comfortable. So there's a comfort zone. And if we get outside that comfort zone and are alone too much, we get anxious. And if we go the other way and are with other people or some other person too much, we get anxious. So Bowen argues that what we're doing every day and in our relationships is trying to figure out how to be with another person or with other people just the right amount of time, and alone just the right amount of time, so we can stay within our comfort zone. And when we're in a relationship, the issue for us is figuring out how to be with the other person just enough and not 24/7. Or how to meditate. How to go for a walk by yourself. How to sleep without somebody jostling you. And whatever it is that annoys you about being together. So we're trying to find a microsystem pattern that lets us be comfortable. We're trying to find a relationship pattern that lets me be comfortably autonomous and together. What decisions do I need to make with you? What decisions can I make by myself? How much time do we spend together? How much time can I spend by myself doing my own thing? And we're constantly adjusting and responding to the anxiety. If I'm too much alone, I'm going to call you up and say, hey, I miss you. Can we do something together? And if we're together too much, okay, I've been with you 37 minutes now, that's enough. I'm going back. I don't need you anymore. Or we've spent, 3 months sleeping in a tent together. I hate you. So we pull away toward the other direction. Now, that's right, does that make sense? Now put it together with the other person. There are two of you, and you both have the same needs, except your comfort zones don't overlap. So while the first person is trying to get more separate, if the couple as a whole has a pattern that lets that person be comfortable, the other person is always anxious. And vice versa. If you're fortunate, there'll be some overlap. And some people have a big, wide comfort zone. I'm fine with people. Fine with lots of people. Long periods of time. I'm fine by myself. Fortunate you are if you're one of those. What's happening in the couple relationship is figuring out how much to be alone, how much to be together, and finding a way of overlapping and maintaining your pattern so that both of you are satisfied, so that neither of you is anxious. And couples develop techniques. For example, if there isn't any overlap, then they decide, okay, if they're smart, they decide, okay, we need to satisfy you half the time and me half the time. So let's negotiate when that's going to be. And take advantage of the times when you're too busy to have a relationship anyway. Then's when I get to be alone. Okay. Or there are periods of time when we're forced to be together, so let's count those as together time. And if I spend 3 weeks with you at your mother's, then I get a weekend all by myself. And some couples have to, because their comfort zones don't overlap, some couples have to negotiate regularly so that they get to spend alternating periods of time in their comfort zones. And they can stay together, but that has to be a negotiation. So knowing a little Bowen can help you stay together. What happens in the early stages of living together is you're together all the time, potentially. So that wasn't happening when you were dating. But when you cohabit, you have to renegotiate that. When you marry, it may get worse. But you're together even more than when you were cohabiting. Establishing the sexual life, we've talked about. Establishing marriage as a zone of safety and nurturance. Is your relationship safe? Are you safe with each other? And that means, can I count on you when I have the flu? Can I count on you when I break my leg and I have a cast that I can't walk on and I have responsibilities? No. Can I do that? Can I count on you to follow through on your commitments? You said you were going to bring home chicken for dinner, and you didn't. Now what do we have for dinner? Are you going to go out of your way, now that we are married, signed, sealed, and delivered, are you going to continue to bring me roses? Or flowers, or put post-it notes on the bathroom mirror? Are you going to nurture me and nurture our relationship, even though we have this commitment? And one of the issues for people is that they court, and courting behavior is, for some of us, it takes a lot of thought and energy. We have to remind ourselves, oh, I'm trying to get this person to marry me and love me, so I need to work on this a little bit. I need to think about it. Once you're married, ha, you don't have to do that anymore. But you've set each other up to expect it. And one of the problems that people have after they marry is because the identity has changed and they're no longer courting because they caught. Ha, got it. Signed, sealed, and delivered. She can't get out of this, so I don't have to be nice anymore. That's an exaggeration. But what happens is that people trail off in their nurturance. And if they become uncomfortable with that, then it becomes not a safe place. Wait a minute, I got married, and this is supposed to be a happy place where we court each other the rest of our lives. But it's not happening. So did I make a bad decision? Is he changing? Is she changing? What's going on here? Does the fact that I'm 8 months pregnant and can't move have anything to do with this? Maybe. I'll see you on Wednesday. I don't know.
Could you please?
Will I take it? That's the other question.
Yeah,
oh, sure. Will I even sign it? Oh, wait a minute. Let me turn this off.